Bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? The University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, LeaderShield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio.
Back coming about 5 minutes. Excuse me. About 5 minutes into hour two, after a meandering first hour, we have to get serious though, because kind of a companion talk to Monday's visit with Rich Migliori, and Tony Black joins us, and you know, Tony a little bit older than Mig. And yeah, just the well, it's probably what about 12, maybe 12 or 13, 14 years older than Meg Tony, and the sad situation involving Avery Wisman last week, and you know, the family communicating. To the industry and to, you know, everybody who was so affected and saddened that it was a self harm situation, and something that, you know, that obviously been affecting him for a number of years apparently. And I, you know, Richie talked Tony about some of the obvious pressures and, you know, the demands, and this is a conversation hardly limited to the racetrack. Right. It's every walk of life. But there are some extenuating circumstances involved for riders, because I imagine, you know, the nutrition aspects,
right,
the diet and the hunger and some of the things that, you know, if it's somebody that has to, you know, that really has to control their intake, there's certain things that make this more hazardous. I mean, and you've discussed in particular self-medicating and,
yes,
some of those life choices. But this is a little different. And I just wanted to turn it over to you and if his experience and there isn't anybody that doesn't know someone who's taken their life. I just wanted you to talk about it from your perspective.
Well, you know what? Right off the bat, you have to understand, and not that it gives anyone an excuse, but this is a mentally and physically a highly stressful athletic event, you know, and it's demanding when it comes to your physical well-being, and it's demanding when it comes to mental well-being. You know, you put so much emphasis on, as a rider or trainer, anybody in this business, on winning. You know, I look at some old pictures, and it's just recently, I looked at pictures of riders and trainers, you know, from like the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and they'd be riding some world-renowned horse, or they trained some horse that had high expectations of, and they're showing win pictures. And I'm thinking to myself when I'm looking at these pictures, you know, it was such an important event to win that race that day. But when we look back at it and you say, can you imagine the pressures that are self-imposed on that rider that rode that horse because he had to win that race that day, you know, or the trainer that trained that horse. And you think, and then you go years later, you look back at these pictures and says, was it really that important? Was it really that important? And you think to yourself, well, I've been in that situation. When I look back, somebody posted a picture of my Juliet winning the Michigan Mile. And it was, you know, a day that I flew out there a couple of days in advance, came and rode her. And I look at the win picture and I say, you know, at the time, it was unbelievable self-pressure and importance put on that particular time or that particular race. And I look back and I think to myself, yeah, but was it really at this day and age and at this part of your life? And you look at things in a different light. Was it really that important? Well, you know what? It's hard sometimes to put yourself back into the years that these things were going on, you know, but you think back, you would have survived and gone on if that horse didn't win. You would have survived and gone on if that situation didn't occur, you know. But at the time, the mindset was, it's got to happen today. I've got to do it. And it's a self-imposed pressure. And this business is built on pressures exerted by the outside forces and self-imposed. Because there's so many things you can do right in this business, but unless it ends up winning, nobody looks at it and says, oh, he really did everything right. Finish second on a horse and ride the best race of your life. I ain't finished second. The winner could have got stopped, you know, or the winner could have ridden, a race that was substandard to his normal performances, and he won. So it's everybody looks at what your last winner was and when's your next winner coming. And it is a tough business. You know, when you see someone that takes their own life, sometimes the first thought that goes through my mind, I wish I could have talked to him. Or I wish I was closer to that person and maybe would have changed the mindset for a particular time period where they would have had second thoughts and maybe came to a different conclusion very shortly thereafter. But, you know, you just see these stories and you can you can understand them because you know the pressures that are exerted. You exert on yourself and the outside forces exert on you. But they're sad stories. They really are. Because years down the road, what would have motivated you into doing something like that won't even seem to be important. You know, when I look at these old wind pitchers, what was the mindset that day? And what's the mindset 5 or 10 or 20 years later? Wasn't that important?
I do want to ask you about another aspect of this when it comes to
self-medication.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second because there's a few very upsetting and just heartbreaking examples of you know, specifically some racetrackers that essentially drank themselves to death, which is a different, you know, it's a different kind of a you know, self-harm. But Tony, in terms of help and in terms of lifelines, I mean, I talked about the other day with Richie in particular, we talked about the racetrack chaplaincy, most notably. And for those that remember the story that Brian Burns of Mount Joy Stables tells and told on the air when we paid tribute to Salty Roberts.
Yeah, Salty. His name just came to mind before you said it.
Well, I mean, there was no... You want to talk about a lightning rod to help people in trouble.
But you know why he was so effective? Really, because there have been chaplains and racetrack chaplains out there that they just came to the racetrack and they've lived in a sterile environment maybe, or they don't relate well to the racetrack. Salty was out there galloping horses. Salty knew what it was to be a jockey. Salty knew what it was to be an exercise rider. Salty was working in the parking lot. And galloping horses in the morning, you know, in Jersey and at different racetracks. But Jersey, I always remember because he worked in the jock slot. Plus, he, you know, he galloped horses in the morning. And he related so well to the average person that threw a leg on each side or that hot walked a horse or that trained a horse because he was out there getting his boots dirty and putting a leg on each side. And working the parking lot and interacting with these people in the jock's lot or the trainer's lot. So he really effectively related to them. And that's why he was so effective in helping them or giving them some good advice. It wasn't advice given by someone that lived in a pristine, sterile environment that just came to the racetrack, you know. It was somebody that was out there getting his hands dirty and working in the trenches just like me. And he was very effective. Salty Roberts was someone that everybody on the backside loved and everybody brushed out shoulders with him. And everybody listened to him when he spoke. And at times he got a chance to have enough experience with the people that he maybe could see something before it actually happened with that person.
Yeah. That's the story that for those that heard it when I heard it live, the year that Smooth Air made it to Derby and I got to know Brian and Benny Stutz and you know everybody and there that's how I got to meet and get to know Salty Roberts. And the story that Brian Burns tells is so stunning and seemingly impossible to believe, but he had met Salty somewhere at a racetrack, probably Chicago.
Might have been in the parking lot.
It could have been. He was introduced to him, and Brian had a business setback. If I'm not mistaken, had a partner essentially empty the bank accounts, and he was in a desperate situation. And he gets a phone call from Salty Roberts, who he had met once, and there was no possible way, there was no ostensible connection, and Brian luckily took the call, and Salty Roberts said to him, Brian, I something told me I needed to call you today.
Yeah.
And it probably saved Brian Burns' life. It changed his life. And it's so, I mean, and Brian to this day, when he tells you the story, the amazement on his face is unbelievable, because this is somebody he had met once, like 6 or 8 months earlier. And
right.
And out of the blue, he calls him and says, I know that you need help, and is there something I can do to help you? Some way I can help you?
That's really understandable, and Walt Salty, interacted and rubbed elbows with these guys on a daily basis. And what you're saying really is just another way of explaining who Salty was. He read people pretty well, but he wasn't, if he did find out something about you, like there was people that would come to him and talk in confidence and say, hey, Salty, so-and-so's having a really terrible time, family problem or financial problem or whatever, business problem. He wouldn't reveal his source and say, oh, Joe Smith just told me you're up against it and I'm here to try to help you come up with some solutions. Sometimes it was just that. He did put information that he got from people to work without revealing his source. And sometimes, you know what? Salty would see you walk in Monmouth Park. He'd be in the jock slot and he would see you walking from your car to the jocks room, and you might have been dragging your ass and the head down or talking to yourself. And then when he saw you at the lunch counter after you got out of the box and pulled 4 or 5 pounds, he would go, hey, jock, everything all right today?
Hmm.
He would do it like that, inconspicuous, But he saw you walk into the jocks room and you're dragging your ass and dragging your feet and maybe talking to yourself or... there were cell phones,
sure,
but they weren't as popular. But he might have heard, saw part of a conversation that you were having with somebody else, and he'd say, I saw you with your girlfriend or wife out there and threw your hands up and saw you walking away, and you guys looked like you were in. Like, but is there anything I can do, to help you out, what's the problem,
Sure.
He was like that. He was a guy that he was an icon in racetrack chaplaincy. That's the best way I can put it, And he took a serious interest in people's well-being. He loved the racetrack. He understood what it could do to people, And he was always there trying to intervene if there was a situation that he thought he could help remedy or give you some advice. Now, the other thing we get into is, other problems. It just doesn't have to do with, oh, can I win this race, or this horse is really important to me, or I got to ride more horses for this trainer. When it comes to racing, riders are subjected, to a lot of pressures, and some of them are more than mental, they're physical. I can remember, and I went through drug and alcohol recovery and abuse and then recovery. But I think back to some of the things that led to my abuse. I can remember one day, and I'm riding a horse in 1978 or 9, whatever, from Mrs. Paxson. It was Candy Eclair. She wound up being best 2-year-old filly in the country that year. I left the gate one day. She's in the Salima Stakes that weekend. But earlier that week, I left the gate, fell leaving the gate, broke my right hand. The right one. So I don't ride the next day. That was like Tuesday, don't ride Wednesday, Thursday. Miss Paxson called me. She said, Tone, Candy Eclair's in the stake on Saturday, the Salima Stakes. This is like a race that's super important.
It's grade one. Grade one at the time.
She said, I have to make sure you're all right. They told me you broke your hand. I says, nah, I just dislocated my thumb. It popped back in. It's not even sore. you know, and it was broke. I mean, I broke it right all the way almost back to the wrist, the right thumb. It's in a cast, right? So I said, I better ride one Thursday just so she don't take me off this horse on Saturday. So I get, you know, my valet's real helpful. We get one around there on Thursday. And now I got to go to Merlin on Saturday and ride. I get a friend of mine who's going to go down with me. He's driving down. That night I had cut the cast back to where the thumb, everything's exposed except a little piece of the under the cast over top of my wrist. I got wrapped a little bit, and I'm thinking, man, I got one around there on Thursday, just to make her, just so somebody couldn't say I'm not riding. I said, I just freshened up Miss Bax, and I'm going to ride on Saturday. I got this thing cut back. You can barely see the cast of bone. It almost came through the skin when I broke it. It didn't. You know, you could see the point in the skin. I got it wrapped where it's inconspicuous, you know, and all the way down there. And this is where the drug part comes in. I'm telling so-and-so, I said, I got a bottle full of Percocets. I says, I'm going to take a few. And when I get to the jocks, we'll take a few. Because, you know, it's very important. This filly's going to be the horse to beat Miss Salima. Well, anyway, I said, but I hope I don't have to hit her because, I just barely can cock my stick if I have to. And if I do, who knows where this bone when I reach down and the stick pressure up against my thumb. It ain't going to feel no good. But don't you know, she leaves the gate. I'm just galloping around there. She's on the lead. She's going to win for fun. And don't you know, Doug Thomas was on a horse. I can't think of the name of the horse. Come running up on the outside of me at the eighth pole, 3/16th pole, the eighth pole. And I got to reach back. I get a wave the stick. And I said, I got to reach back and crack this bitch. And I reach back, crack her a couple of times. And I'm thinking, geez, those guys, well, don't you know she hangs on and wins? I cracked her like 3-4 times. Doug was, I can't think of the name of horse Doug was on, whatever, but it don't matter. I'm thinking, I thought the one thing I didn't want to do is have to go back and hit her. But she won. She just did. She won. And I waved a stick at her, which was all right, but the hit made the difference. When I come back, my thumb had disappeared from what little bit it was under the cast, that what was left of the cast. You don't even see the end of my thumb. I get back to the jock's room, and of course I go right to the emergency room, and the doctor there said, Jesus Christ, we've got to operate on this thing. He says, I'll give you some, right now I'm going to just try to get the bone where it's not pressing up against the skin. And he gives me a shot on it. Now, I've taken Percocets. I didn't care about the pain or nothing. I would just win $150,000 at it or whatever it was, There was no pain. He gives me a shot under my arm. It wasn't down in Merlin. I left Merlin, came home, and went the next morning to the doctor, Dr. Brown. And I never had a block under my arm like this, but he hit me with these needles underneath my arm where you couldn't even feel your hand. And I never forget, he says, he told his nurse, make sure you hold his hand down because this thing might go swinging. I don't know which direction. And then he says, once I reset the thing, and he puts his foot up on the table and he pulls my thumb out with his brace and himself with his foot up on the table. He says, now you'll probably have to get this thing operated on, but I'll cast it right now. And I'm thinking, all I got to do is take more Percocets and whatever. We'll get through this. And in 4 weeks, I was riding again, or 5 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever it was. And I'm thinking, never got it operated on. And I'm thinking, that's just one small, little story about riders and what they're faced with. Here, on Tuesday, you fall. On Saturday, you got to ride a major stake on a horse that's up for the Eclipse Award. And you're doing it with a broken hand, and you're telling the Miss Paxson, Henry D. Paxson stable, I was just okay, it's all right. And to this day, I don't know if she ever heard the story that it wasn't. She's not alive anymore. But it wasn't just dislocated. The only thing that was dislocated was my sobriety with all those Percocets. But I rode all right on Percocet. But you know what? I think back to days like that. Now, what was that, 79? And, and it was years and
78.
Years, probably days and experiences where you did have to self-medicate or thought you needed to. And then self-medication just got to be, what can you call it? Fun? It ain't fun, but it just got to be a part of life. And before you knew it, you were abusing alcohol and drugs. And in December 15th, 1990, I got clean and sober again.
Well, a couple of things, Tony, about that. And the horse that Thomas was on was...
What was the name of that horse?
Drop Me a Note.
Drop Me a Note. Yeah, that's who it was. Yeah, Drop Me a Note. I couldn't think of it. And when he come running up to me on the 8th pole, wherever it was, D16, so I says, oh, Jesus Christ, I gotta reach out and crack this bitch.
Well,
and we got there in front of Drop Me a Note.
Well, and also, but Herbie Hinosa came running too, with a horse of T.J. Kelly's, Whisper Fleet.
Man, nice horses, kind of nice horses, but you know what? That was the race that gave Candy Eclair the edge, where she was voted for Eclipse Award that year.
She was champion 2 year old.
Two-year-old filly.
But they split it with that horse. I think it's a Lucas, right? There was a 2 year old filly, a Lucas's. I think they shared the title.
Yeah, that's right. It was co-champions, and that was one of Mrs. Paxton's homebreds, and it was amazing how she had a little farm in Pennsylvania and wound up breeding a few horses a year, and she was such a nice lady to ride for. She always had nice horses. In fact, when I started riding for her after I won a few races, she says, I'm going to give you a retainer. I think it was either $1,000 or $2,000 a month for first call. First trainer. That's the first owner ever did that for me. And she gave me a retainer every month. And of course you couldn't ride against her. You know, it was a first call situation. You could either rode her horse or you couldn't ride against her, but who wanted to ride against her? And all she wanted to do was to ride her horses. She had some really nice horses. I think Critical Miss was one of her horses. But some of them were homebreds, Forlana and Fortake. They were either purchases or homebreds. But she was a great lady to ride for. But you know what? Some of the things I did when it came to having to be a jockey and putting so much importance on certain situations, you know, self-medication, yeah. You know, self-pressure that you put on the pressure you put on yourself mentally. I got to win this race. Oh, geez, this is really important. And of course, you tried to take that anxiety and put it aside when it came to going out there on the racetrack. And the one thing I'd always do is go out on the racetrack saying, this is what I've trained to do all these years. Anxiety, leave me alone. You know, put it aside, because anxiety can do to an athlete some terrible things. It utilizes your energy and your mental capability ineffectively and inefficiently. Hmm. Yeah, anxiety is a terrible thing to have to deal with. And then when I hear people say, oh, I got anxiety. Well, you know what? I don't take that lightly. And somebody that may acts off of that anxiety, it might be anxiety, might be self-pressure, might be self-medication or a combination of all those things. And you hit a moment of weakness, maybe take your own life. You know, and that's where you say, boy, I wish I could be around that person before they did this. Because what they're putting, the pressure they're putting on themselves of things that are important, maybe 6 hours, 6 years, 6 days, whatever from now, the importance won't be so significant, and you go on with life. But you know what? It's, like I said, a highly stressful mentally and physically an athletic event, and it carries a tremendous amount of stress, self-induced in many occasions, with it.
Well, Tony, I appreciate this. As always, it's not the easiest topic, and it wasn't on Monday, but you've got a way of delivering these kinds of conversations like nobody else, so I appreciate it.
One more thing. When I was in the midst of an addiction, I wanted to quit riding, and I thought to myself, man, this riding is, I just want to quit. And all of a sudden, I came to the conclusion, you know, riding is interfering with my drug and alcohol use. Drug and alcohol use is interfering mm-hmm. with my career, my riding. And then I came to that conclusion. I says, listen, Black, you better straighten up, because there ain't no future for you like this. And I was lucky enough to have family and people that stood by me that helped me get through it. And that was December 15th, 1990. I was broke, couldn't buy my son his 10th birthday present. for his 10th or 11th birthday. I was broke. I was looking at a jar of pennies trying to put some money together. We got through it.
Yeah, you got through it and then some. Well, yeah. Tony, thank you.
Take care, Steve. You keep up the good work. You know I love you, brother. And racing needs people like you, but especially they need you, brother.
You're too kind. Tony Black, he's unbelievable. Love you too, Tony, everybody. And a terrific, as always, just a terrific discussion. And I'm glad we got a chance to, you know, offer a nod to Salty Roberts, because his work, you know, really... with him, you know, now he's gone, but his work when it came to the, when it's come to the chaplaincy, I mean, and all the people the chaplaincy has helped, it all, you know, he's the foundation sire when it comes to the work of the Racetrack Chaplaincy, RTCA, and always a excellent option for when it comes to giving. So let's I was thinking about maybe taking a bottom break, but let's press on, and we'll get a conversation in with Joe Clancy, who once again has been out. The Clancys are not just the Clancys, but the whole This Is Horse Racing Saratoga Special team. They're outdoorsmen. They're a hardy sort. what do they say about pioneer stock? That would be appropriate because he was out in the woods with the dogs.
I'm back.
You're back. Any game? Any grouse or pheasants to
no,
grouse?
No. She was looking for them, but no.
Are they bird dogs? What kind of dogs?
No, it's just it's one dog, and it's a Labrador Retriever. So I guess she's technically a bird dog, but she doesn't really. I don't know what she would do if you took her hunting.
Well, they're notoriously flighty, no?
Yeah, no, she's pretty good. She, you know, their job, if she was actually a working hunting dog, would be go get the birds that somebody shot, you know. And they otherwise stay close to you until you tell them to go do that. In theory, my dog just runs around the woods and chases deer and other things, finds and comes back most of the time.
Well, the coolest, here we go, right off into the woods like a shanked tee shot. Thanks a lot, Joe.
No problem.
The most interesting, I've not had any experience. I think the last time I shot a gun, I was in summer camp, you know, target, you know, BB target kinds of gun. The most interesting hunting dog experience I've ever seen. My girlfriend at the time had relatives in from Kansas City. Had relatives though in Charleston, South Carolina, and we stayed with her cousins. Her uncle owned a very famous. The top pawn shop, actually, in Charleston. George's Loan, I believe. And everybody called him George, but that wasn't his name. He had bought the shop from George, like, 50 years earlier. And the family called him Sweet, because he had blonde hair, but that wasn't his name either. Now I can't even remember her uncle's name. The cousins had a condo out on Kiowa Island. Right? Is it Kiowa that's off of Charleston?
Yeah. Yeah.
It figures that you would know this, being the landed aristocracy you are.
I was just there, believe it or not, but whatever, that's another story.
Well, so her cousin, we're staying at her cousin's, and the condo had like a dock that went right into like you know, the marsh and out into the water. And he would open the screen door, the porch door, and they had a dog, this furry thing that looked like a spaniel. And he would open the door, and the thing would run down the dock and I mean dive into the water. I've never seen anything like it. And it was the first time I had ever heard about a Boykin. A Boykin? Is that it? A Boykin Spaniel?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
It is specifically a South Carolina water retrieval dog that it absolutely is bred to go swim and pluck out the goose or the duck you just popped out of the air, the poor unsuspecting thing that he was. And but that's what it was. It's a Boykin, and I now you see them. I'm sure it's Boykin, and now you see them in Westminster and stuff. But at the time, this is like the 80s, and I think they were still a fairly. I don't know when they were accepted into AKC, but it was very cool. That's my bird dog story.
Somewhere in my dog's ancestry, there's some bird dogs, but she is just a pet. But otherwise, she enjoys the fields and hills and whatever of Fair Hill pretty much every day.
Well, and here you go. I can now, much like the guy whose voice is so familiar to those of us that watch Westminster, here, I can now read just like him. Here we go. I just saw it and I just lost it. A medium-sized flushing and retrieving dog known for its rich brown coat, the Boykin Spaniel is avid, eager, merry, and trainable. This mellow house dog and tenacious bird dog was once South Carolina's best-kept secret. Boykins are medium-sized spaniels, larger and rangier than Cockers, but more compact than Springers. Here is the Boykin Spaniel.
And we all applaud quietly, right? Is that what we're supposed to do now?
Yes, golf clap. Golf clap. There you go. Westminster clap. This is Joe. You haven't been around, but you've been out in the woods, chasing Muffin. But what's the dog's name, by the way?
Katie.
Well, I was close with Muffin.
Yeah, right there.
It's been an unusual an hour and a half. So you got to get us back in the fairway. Why were you at Kiowa?
I was there in December running a marathon.
Of course. You and Paul Bunyan, Tom Law.
Yeah, my wife Sam and I went down there. She ran the half, I ran the full, and then we had Bill Gallo has a house on Kiowa Island, so we had dinner with Bill and KT as well. So there was a little bit of work done and a little bit of socializing done as well.
It's easier probably to keep track of places that Bill Gallo doesn't have a house.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he loves that we're discussing this on air.
Unbelievable. I haven't been back to Kiowa in a long time. I took Tina to Charleston when we did that wonderful trip that we had, the antebellum. She met me in New Orleans, and then
that
was great. She met me in New Orleans after Risen Star. It was her February break, and then we stopped the first night in Mobile. Then I got her to Savannah for like three nights, and then a couple of nights in Charleston. But Savannah is my favorite. Savannah, I'd go live in Savannah. Not being able to play online, Savannah is just magical. When I was in Charlotte working for Procter & Gamble, I used to have to go down there a lot. And both towns, Charleston and Myrtle, and the whole coast. Of the two towns, Charleston and Savannah, and that was in the I got to Charlotte, which I hated. I got to Charlotte in '86, February of '86, and Charleston has changed, and Savannah has not. So Savannah is the same town that it was in the '80s. Charleston's allowed construction, modern construction, which is shocking to me, that they would befoul, you know, the sort of the, you know, the architectural integrity. Savannah, you cannot build anything. They guard that like, have you been to Savannah?
I've been through Savannah and have planted a flag and said we're going back there someday, but we haven't been back. But yeah, it looks like a great place to. And we know, like you, we know other people who rave about it. So
unbelievable.
Yeah, sounds like a cool place. And I'm with you. I like the places that preserve. I mean, some of the sections of Charleston still have that, but yeah, you can tell it's become more of a. It's become more of a city, which, you know, that's what happens.
Yep. Very much.
I love the places that preserve that stuff.
No, highly recommend. So get there with, and you gave, it's funny. I got to get you to where we want to retire. And, and last spring, I got to see where you are ultimately going to retire at St. Michael's.
Gona. I don't know about Gona, but, there's a list of potentials, put it that way.
Well, we enjoyed, you know, I was watching, what were we watching over Christmas? And there was a scene in some series or in some bingey thing that we watched that was in St. Michael's. They were walking down that main drag.
Right.
And I said to Tina, I said, look, it's St. Michael's. I can't remember now what this was. But it was very cool for those that, I actually had a couple of recommendations. It's funny this comes up. That's one of them. As Triple Crown season approaches, that is a highly recommended. You can just drive out to Annapolis, and there's these excursions. It's about 2 hours back and forth, and they give you about 2.5 hours at St. Michael's. It was so much fun.
Yeah, it's a cool little town. It is really doable from you know, if you're in Maryland for the Preakness or the sale or whatever and can steal a day, it's a cool way to do it and a cool way to see it. And I'm with you. I kind of like those. I like places like that. They're a little off the beaten path, but they have, they have their own nucleus of activity that makes you want to stay there.
Well, and that was during the weekend, that week at in Maryland, it was like 112 degrees. It was like Preakness on the sun. Right?
And sometimes you get over to the Eastern Shore and it's not like that at all, you know. So that's again because you're you know up the other side of the bay and it can be a little different, which is fun.
We had a tremendous time. Well, how was your? We haven't spoken. This is your first visit of the year, and we will get Wee Sean next week because we did talk to Law already. Although we have not had Law on to Fett. I'll be at the Breakers next Thursday. Is that a week?
Nice.
That's a week from today, right?
Week from today, yeah. Eclipse Award winner Tom Law. Yes, you know, come on.
Well, what do you think? It can't be easy being working with the Clancys. We have got like seven of them between you.
No. We each have. Well, Tom technically has two or one and a half because he shares one with Greg Charcutian. So we each have one. So maybe we should stop entering. We'll just leave it that way.
That's true, because then one of you can probably say I deserve more money. And then it'll get ugly.
There's no money.
No, there's no money. Exactly. We're all content. Most of us. There are the Ganefs and Schnurrers that are, that have been that have been nursing on the industry teat for forever. Don't get me started, because I'm in the mood to launch.
Oh,
there is potential for that, Joe.
Back to Tom Law briefly and his Eclipse Award. I was thrilled for him when that came out, and it was I was as happy for him as if I won or Sean won or anybody else. And that little, I call it little magazine, Mid Atlantic Thoroughbred, you know, gets an Eclipse Award for the second year in a row of a story.
It's amazing.
A hand in, and you know, I think it's great. I mean, that's the idea. We kind of struggle over some of the processes of a still doing a monthly print magazine in this day and age, but that's, you know, you get rewarded like that every now and then, and it's kind of fun.
Very much.
You know, and couldn't happen to anybody better or anybody who works harder.
Well said, well put. In terms of the start of the new year, what have you been tracking? Or, you know, you're eligible actually to even kind of wrap up. We haven't talked to you about eclipses. In fact, we'll get the winners next week. Is there anything? Do you anticipate anything from your ballot that might constitute a shock or surprise in your estimation?
I don't think so. I mean, there were a few, you know, tricky decisions like everybody else. You struggled over the three. You struggled with the 3-year-olds a little bit, just trying to pick. Okay, who do you land on here? And I landed on Epicenter, but you know, I understand the other directions people went. The female turf. It might have been that was another one that was tricky. And you know, but I landed on Warlike Goddess. But I think they all. There's four or five who are deserving champions and would win in, you know, another year where there wasn't another horse who had such a good year. It was one of those weird years where, like back in the day, they kind of just did a turf horse. Well, maybe this year we should have just done a turf horse too and let one of the female turfers win it and call it a day. But it should be, the rest were fairly straightforward and weren't too tricky. I went Snap Decisions way in the steeplechase stuff. Mostly because I try not to vote for the horses who only run once in North America. That's probably an old guy stance, but whatever. I kind of do that in every division, you know, so, or try to. That's where we are. But it'll be fun. I mean, again, that all gets done. It's a week from today, right?
Yeah, it'll be that Thursday. The month is already, it's actually
flying by.
It really has. It's scary, to be honest. And I did not necessarily, what just happened? We've also, frankly, 3 weeks into the year, it's been rather sedate, Joe, right? Am I imagining?
Don't poke the bear.
I know. You're right. You're right. Good point.
But yes, the list of things to do in January. Like I can't believe I'm this far into it. You know, but we'll get into the month, not the list. But
got it.
We are. I mean, but mostly it's been Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred. The February edition's about to go to the printer hopefully tomorrow. Vinnie Perrone did a lengthy kind of career retrospective feature on Dale Capuano, which was
a little
bit of a surprise when he announced that. And you know, it's really stalwart Mid-Atlantic career, you know, just forever. And as only Vinnie can, kind of spend a couple days with him and put together a neat story.
How much writing is Vinny doing?
Not racing writing, not that much. He's got a bunch of other projects and irons in the fire that he's dealing with, but he pops up and either volunteers or I volunteer him to tackle a feature every now and then for the magazine. Sort of just depends on his time frame. And he had covered Dale a lot at the Washington Post, you know, in his early days.
Yeah.
Covering racing and was kind of the perfect person to do it. I was thrilled when I was about to call him and he called me. So, and he was there the last day on the 31st and, you know, spent that day with him and spent a couple other days and kind of handed the stable over to his nephew who's off and running and doing pretty well with the horses too. So, horse trainers don't get a chance to retire very often. So I think it's great. You know, we did figure out that he's probably less than 15 wins away from a couple of Maryland legends. And he's just behind Buddy Delp and, Dick Dutrow. And you're like, I might've stuck it out if we could get a couple wins ahead of them. But, it's still kind of a monumental thing, really. And it's a good story. Again, it'll be in the February edition.
Well, and I've got to get him on. I haven't had a chance since coming back from the break. So I owe him a visit, too, as it happens. Nice. Well, and let's also, given, you know, what we're dealing with, not that there's any snow, but you're really not, you know, we're probably 60 days away from you guys starting to, you know, start to solicit for the
Yikes.
23 Saratoga special. You're really not that far off.
No, we're not. And we need to have a once Mr. Law gets back from Florida and accepting his major award, we need to get down to some of the things we're going to try to get ahead of at least a little bit in terms of Saratoga, as usual. February is a good. If you didn't do it in January, February is the next best thing to try to get ahead on some of the planning you got to do before everything really starts to take off for us in March. Obviously, the jump season cranks back up. The Mid-Atlantic's pretty steady and plenty to do, and Tom's chasing a lot of stuff with the Horseman's Journal, and yeah, there's plenty to do. So then Saratoga will be here before we know it.
True enough. And then, of course, because I probably, well, I'm going to talk next to Dave Hill, and we'll go over the four games. But one of the things that has gotten me as close to the Clancys as I've gotten is that we share a common illness.
That's well put.
And it's an illness that, frankly, Sean is too young to appreciate, Joe. I mean, you and I, and Johnny D, we can commiserate. I mean, I'm old enough to remember Jerry Williams and Eddie Kayat and Mark McCormick and
Mike McCormick, right? That was the coach. That's the first coach that I think I remember yelling at.
it's been a treat in recent years, you know, especially 5 years ago. This has been a fun week and a half, give or take, because you know we're getting these 5 year reminders and anniversaries of the 2017, you know, and the Super Bowl. And anyway, Eagle fans that are we're a special breed, and I don't care, you know, no one likes us, and we don't care.
Exactly. It's been a little stressful here. You know, you don't get the daily Philadelphia sports radio. Like, there's a lot of stress over the last the shoulder injury with Jalen Hurts and whatever else. But you know, I think the game can't get here soon enough for some people just to alleviate some of that worry and back and forth as to is everything okay? You know, based on the last two, 3 games of the season. Have people in a worried state of mind despite a 14-3 season.
I know, about as good as it possibly could have gone. And and they're just, you know, they're so rare. I did tell the story yesterday, you know, because I'm an Eagle fan because of my father, and my father's an Eagle fan because of a South Philly kid in Brooklyn that my dad met when my dad came to the U.S. in 1939. And, you know, those two teams in 1947 and 1948. And just the anniversary yesterday of the second championship. I was telling, who was I telling? Dick Powell yesterday about it. But I am funny. I don't know what, for somebody that doesn't live in the area. I mean, I was a season ticket holder with my friend Phil for years, section 729 in the Vet, but I would drive from Montreal for games, 7 hours, back and forth.
Wow. Wow.
Just crazy.
That's fandom.
You know, well, I would, and you know, Phil and his brother, they grew up in Wilmington in part. But you know, we had a block of like four, so I didn't have to come. I wouldn't go to all eight games, but five was pretty much the minimum that I would get down for. And it's just a mania. And I mean, you say about, you know, about not being there, you know, to listen to WIP every day. Yeah, that would make me, that would really make me insane. But I,
exactly.
That would really drive me crazy. But I follow a million, whether it's, you know, I get the Inquirer. I'm subscribed online to the Inquirer. But, well, between, you know, Johnny and I and Will Schwartz, we've got an ongoing, chat, text chain. That's always Eagle related and racing. But I follow a ton of interesting, you know, unusual fans that you just come across when you follow something. That's Twitter at its best, actually, is having fellow travelers at your fingertips.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Exactly. At its best, for sure. There's plenty of things that are at its worst, but yeah, I'm with you. Some of his discoveries like that are great and make it worthwhile as you kind of, sift through some of the other parts of it.
Oh, exactly. Especially, somebody made a point that it just, you're not seeing for whatever this clown has done, you're just not seeing the same feed that, I got to go looking for, you know, some of the people, you know, that I rely on and people that I want to, you know, see on a regular basis. And you have to, if you go, it seems like if you go and see, like you, let's say, if you go, you know, Joe Clancy 65, and if you go a few times, a few days in a row, and all of a sudden your feed, suddenly I start seeing your feed again. It's a little maddening that, you know, you don't get, what, and I know people say that if you play with the controls, you can.
I keep trying to make it default to latest tweets as opposed to whatever their algorithm is trying to send me, but that's harder than it seems sometimes. I don't, to me, the whole beauty of Twitter back when it, the whole reason I went to it, I think, was because it didn't try to force feed you stuff it thought you wanted. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
and now it does.
Well, Andy gave me a great. I was complaining about all these ads, and frankly, they're, you know, the ads are, they're like the late night TV kind of products. And Andy gave me a great. He said, just go up to the account that the ad is from, and mute the advertiser. And I've been doing that every time I see a, you know, promoted, I mute the advertiser, and it's made a huge difference, actually. So the Andy gave me that idea, and that's a winner. So there you go.
Yeah, but I like it. Tips.
Exactly. Life hack.
Life hacks.
Which is a term I hate.
But
not as much as New Shooter. There's nothing that makes me the hair stand up in the back of my neck and rankles me like New Shooter. The worst. Brutal. Personal thing.
I'm that way about red, white, or blue hot.
Oh, red hot, white hot,
white hot, blue. Like, come on, just stop it.
Does it have to be a color? Does the
right,
heat?
Yeah, and it just be
interesting.
Hot.
Interesting. Well, white hot is the hottest, right?
I thought blue was, but again, I don't know, and that's why it was part of what rankles me.
Well, but be careful because the blue heat, of course, is your gas oven, which.
Oh, now we're here. We go.
Well, that's one of the funniest things. I haven't talked about this. That's one of the funniest things going on right now is this whole, you know, the concern about, about the gas and the toxins in the house. And we've got a gas stove and it's fairly new. And this was the most expensive gas stove in history because we got it at Lowe's. It was a like a scratch and dent. Somebody had returned it, and it was a really expensive gas stove. And we got a gas furnace, so I said to the team, "This is a hell of a bargain. We're going to save like $2,200 on this thing." So we buy it and we get it brought home, and they bring it home, they deliver it, And then I bring in the guy, you know, to run the line from the basement, you know, up into the kitchen. And he says, I can't do this. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, I can't bring it outside. I can't go out and then up and then in. So what are we going to do? So the thing sits on the back porch for close to a year. While
unused,
and so we do discover the guy says, "Well, here's what I possibly could do. I could, if it's on an interior wall, and I could run the line up around this way and through the stairs from your basement around the perimeter of the stairs, and bring it up to an interior wall. But I can't do it on an exterior wall, which is where our old electric stove was." So, Joe, you know where this story is going, of course, because $38,000 later, the kitchen, correct, the kitchen gets remodeled, ostensibly because of the $2,200 we saved on the stove. And now we find out that it's going to kill our grandchildren. And it's a complete type of situation. Yes, Lou, it was a Shell station. It's just unbelievable. So anyway, I you said blue hot and it made me think of the pilot light. So let me tell you though, I'll tell you one thing. You the power goes out for 36 hours, you'll be the most popular person in the neighborhood.
We're all electric over here, but if I had a gas furnace or something like that, I would probably have a gas stove. But yeah, either we're all electric or an oil heat, so there's really no sense adding more. Like just because of what you just went through,
crazy
not to do it.
I do love the new kitchen was totally worth it, and then I took all the old kitchen and put it in the basement. And so there was a second, we have basically, I could turn this into a catering hall. I'm not kidding. We've got the stove downstairs and a fridge. There's for the first time ever in my life, Joe, we've got a second fridge. Right?
We're the opposite. We just got rid of ours. Like, we had a fridge in the garage. And I'm like, with no children in the house, I don't need a second fridge anymore. So, you know.
Well, that was I was so envious as a kid of my friend Jimmy McDonald. You know, his dad, they had the fridge in the garage. Same thing.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, and that's where they would keep, you know, the extra. He'd keep the beer in there, and we could sneak beers out of there.
Kids could hide the soda. You'd sneak the sodas. Oh. The parents would say you can't have any more Coke, but you knew there was some in the garage. We had one in the barn that you could do that. That's where the sodas were that mom and dad didn't know.
Too funny. Well, Joe, you've been invaluable. You managed to spend a half hour, and we got at least 6 minutes of. Yeah.
My only horse racing opinion at the moment is that Proxy is going to run really well in Pegasus. How's that?
Okay. All right. That's an alternative.
Right. There you go.
That is an alternative. Cyberknife and White Arborio feel like the central characters.
Right. I'm taking a stand against them. Mike Stidham. You know, he's older horse getting better all the time.
Interesting. Yeah. All right.
That's my theory.
All right. That's a good, that people will remember this, and they'll remember it when they order next year's calendar, and they'll say, Joe bought this calendar for me with Proxy. The one and only Joe Clancy, 65, and of course, by Sean Clancy and Saratoga TL. And this is horseracing.com until Saratoga special season rolls back along. Joe, let's get lucky. Hopefully there aren't too many drunk patrons Saturday night at the link. It's a lot asking asking the Eagles faithful to stay sober somewhat to 8:30 at night. That was not the NHL's best decision, NFL's best decision.
No, I'm with you. Like, and it's a long time to wait.
Exactly. Well, we're waiting for Dave Hill to tell us who to play. Joe, thanks a lot. We'll talk in a few weeks.
Thanks for having me. See you.
Too much fun. Joe Clancy, everybody, and there's the group. Let's take the second time out and come back with Dave Hill. Dave Hill 77 on your Twitter. And I haven't looked for his column yet, so I'll pull up the column. And we'll see about Dave's opinions for the four divisional games as we start to really drill down in the NFL season. Dave Hill next at the Races. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research.